It's Investigative Podcast Week, and this time Stick Figure Squad is underneath the magnifying glass. Is their vision for this podcast a perfect 2020? Find out on this episode of America's Next Top Podcaster. Welcome to America's Next Top Podcaster. I'm Brian Ibbett. It's the Stick Figure Squad's showcase for Investigative Week, and Kristen, Melissa, and Bobby are putting together their submission. As winners of last week's challenge, they got a bonus coaching session with Scott Philbrook, the co-host of the Astonishing Legends podcast. We'll eavesdrop on that coaching session, as well as the one with Tom, but before any of that, let's touch base with Bobby. Bobby Frankenberger from Stick Figure Squad. Hey, Bobby, how you doing?
Hey, Brian, I'm making it. I'm doing all right.
First off, congratulations on your win for Comedy Week. From watching things in the Discord, it was a tense week with you guys. Or not tense, but just a busy week.
Tense is the right word.
Was it tense?
I mean, I don't know. It's been rough. And this whole thing is rough, right? Like, this is a difficult competition, and I want to make sure that I'm clear when I say that there's a lot more good than bad,
of course.
And I'm really enjoying it, of course, and it's super rewarding. But it's very difficult, emotionally difficult.
Yeah, I mean, when you've got three people or four people sometimes on a team, and they're all pitching different ideas or shooting down other ideas or not understanding what you're trying to convey, I can absolutely sympathize with how that is. I've been on those kind of teams before, and so I can completely relate.
And to that, like, I don't know. I've struggled because it's just been an emotionally exhausting couple of weeks. But like, when you're doing something creative, and you're like what you find good and where you find your creativity and especially when it comes to something artistic like this, and like a lot of that comes from deep inside you, right? Like, and it's based on years, decades of life experience and what you believe to be good or bad in a creative way, like that's based on you, like as a person. So it can be those types of disagreements on that level aren't like the types of disagreements you have when you're trying to figure out what to go get for dinner,
right. They feel very personal because they come from some place that's very, that's very
close. It can
close
sometimes feel like when someone's attacking your ideas that they're attacking you because it feels like a part of you. And I try not to take that personally, but there is a lot of emotional energy that goes into fighting for the things you believe in, but also trying not to take it personally, and trying to stay objective. And me and some of my teammates, we have I don't want to say contradictory, I don't know. It's difficult to talk about it without sounding like I'm accusing people of this or
of
that,
course,
but which I'm not. But it's hard. I mean, it's hard.
And I can tell from the Discord chats and especially from hearing you guys, during the judging and elimination episodes that you guys all really like and support each other and really appreciate what each of you brings to the table. So I can totally get that. I mean, I know you don't want to be, oh no, this person totally is that, and I'm like this to this other person. And no, I totally get it. I know exactly what you're saying.
And it's go ahead, Brian.
And Comedy Week is one of those things that it just brings out the most emotion in people, because what one person finds funny, another person doesn't find funny. And
comedy's intensely personal, I think.
It is. It is. And you've got all have to be rowing that boat at exactly the same time to make it work.
And that's another part of it. I think if you just approached this like, this is a competition and I'm on a team and I'm here to make something and hope, like if you just approached it that way and thought about it as you're trying to make it from week to week in this competition, it'd be different and maybe easier to disconnect yourself from that. But it's a firm belief of mine, like I hate talking about it because it feels bad to sort of brag, but I've been on a team that's won 4 out of 5 weeks. And I do believe that that's not me. That's us working as a team and saying to ourselves, like, we are going to do this as a team. We're not competing with each other right now.
Right.
We have to do this together. And that creates even more intense emotionality to it. Like, cause you are supporting each other
of course.
Saying like, we can do this, you know, like you're taking on other people's, like insecurities on yourself and saying, no, we have got this together. And it's, I don't know, I'm getting emotional just talking about it, but
sure. No. And I totally get it. Is there thought at all, or is it too early to even be thinking about the solo, you know, that at some point we're going to be switching to solo? Or are you thinking about really just thinking about, nope, let's get through this next week and let's get through this next week? And
that's what I try to do. I mean, I think it's impossible to not think like you're hoping that you're going to make it.
Sure. Sure.
Like, I really do hope I make it. This competition's really been great for me, and it's very important to me in a lot of ways. But I do try to focus on the team, and some of my other teammates will express those types of concerns. Like, what if, you know, we're not thinking about it this way? What, you know, or I really want to make it this far, or how do we beat this or that? And, you know, just trying to meta game it, so to speak, you know. And I've right. reminded them, like, guys, there will be time to compete against each other if we make it that far, right?
Sure.
So what we have to do right now is try as hard as we can to be the ones who make it that far.
To make it that far.
Yeah,
it totally makes sense. You guys, I think we're absolutely 100% on the right track with the whole, all right, well, let's see if it passes the Jenny Josephson test, the editing that you guys did. I think that was brilliant. And bringing it up or including the credits was even a great way to kind of reinforce that and say, all right, Jenny, what do you think? Did we do okay? I mean, there may have been a little bit of risk. And if she did notice any editing issues, then it's
that.
You put it to the test and now it failed.
Yeah.
But no, to me, that sounded like one long cut. So I was amazed by that whole
thing. I'm glad you noticed the little bit, because that's exactly what I was doing when I added it on the end there. Because I was trying to think, like, when we talk about it, I was like, I want to think of a way that I can be like, hey, Jenny, we're paying attention. and that was like my little funny way to get that in. So
it was a great addition. All right, so Comedy Week behind us now. Is there a relief now that we're in kind of an investigative, or is it really just like, well, it's a whole different kind of pressure, but it's still pressure?
It's a different kind of pressure. So it's kind of back to the old routine. I've always said to everybody that the hardest part for me is the first day or two of every week.
Yeah,
because you have to come up with that concept, and that's when you have the most disagreements, or at least that's been my experience so far. Because everybody, again, it's a personal thing, right? Everybody's got an idea of what their concept is, and you have to figure out how to either come to a consensus and a synthesis on what that concept is going to be, or you have to decide we're not coming to that synthesis and we just have to go with one. And that can be a tough thing back and forth. I think that this will be week, once we get to that point, which we're working on it, it will be easier, because with comedy, you know, it's a never ending, like, you know, punching things up and trying to make them funny, and you never know what's working and what's not. But I feel like with this sort of thing that we're doing now, with an investigation thing, like at least I feel like I have a grasp on how to do that. In a lot of ways, we did that with Science Week. We made something that I would think would be very similar to what we, I feel like if we had done that this week, it would have qualified. We're obviously not going to do the same thing again.
please don't. Yeah. Right.
Just resubmit it.
But yeah, I mean, it's a very friend heavy week where you've got to kind of decide on the topic and start doing the research. Whereas comedy, it's constant pressure throughout the whole
week.
There will be pressure later on in the week as you're editing and putting stuff together, but if you've got a solid concept, a solid idea, then all that stuff happens at the beginning.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, I'm excited to hear what you guys come up with. So yeah. I'm going to let you guys get back to it. Thank you so much, Bobby.
Thanks, Brian.
Your special guest coaching session this time around is with someone who's no stranger to the strange. Scott Philbrick is the co-host of Astonishing Legends, a show that for the past 5 years has been digging deep into stories behind bizarre and unusual events and locations. Stick Figure Squad meets Scott Philbrick.
Hello. Hello, everybody. It's great to be here. Thank you very much. All right. Hello. Hey, guys. How you doing?
Hi. Bobby, what do you want? Hi, Scott. I think what the first question we might have is kind of very preliminary, but it might get us on the right track here. What tools do you use to find a topic?
Wow. Finding a topic. That's actually probably one of the hardest questions with us because that is very organic to me and my co-host and our general interests. Forrest and I have always been fascinated with the kinds of things that we talk about. The one thing that we do that I don't know a lot of shows are doing, but maybe more of them are now, is that we are not afraid to venture outside of what's our perceived parameters. Because when we started, we felt like the genre as a whole that we're in had a problem of taking itself too seriously and being too melodramatic and that sort of thing. And also just focusing on real particular types of stories. So we're not afraid to actually get into something that might be a historical mystery that has a very small paranormal component to it, or maybe even none at all if it's significantly interesting to us. So, but before we started, we had a folder with over, believe it or not, 1,000 different potential topics in it that we had been working on for a couple of years before we got off the ground. So that's where our stuff usually comes from. But every now and then we'll spontaneously choose a topic as well. And now that we're more established, we get emailed ideas all the time, or we stumble across things because we're in different chat groups and message boards where we're monitoring this kind of stuff. Or a lot of times our listeners in our groups that follow us on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter will say, "Hey, this one you just did totally reminded me of this thing." And 8 times out of 10, we've heard of the thing they're suggesting.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we've already considered it, but every now and then one will come through and we'll be like, "What is this?" And we'll dig into that. And if it's sufficiently interesting to both of us, we'll jump on it, even though we've got however many other ones sitting in a folder languishing and waiting for us to pick things out when mm-hmm. we're running out of ideas.
A question that I had was, like, how do you balance between storytelling and the investigation part? Because I think that's one thing that we're kind of struggling with.
That's really, that's one of the hardest parts of it, actually. Because a lot of times with a story or with an investigation, you'll find that there's not much of a story there, or there's not a story that you can tell. You know, these in our case with folklore and paranormal history and legendary stories, everything doesn't always fall into a 3-act structure, and it becomes really difficult to eke a story out of it. So that's something that we've learned from trial by fire. I would love to say that, you know, either one of us attended journalism school, and if I won the lottery tomorrow, and I'd need time more than money, frankly, at this point, I would go back to school and study journalism. I would love to have gotten some formal training in how to make a story out of real life events. But as it is, we've just learned by doing it the wrong way, especially if you listen to our earlier shows. The way that the tales are stitched together is a lot messier than it is now. At least I'd like to think it is. I don't know if that's really true. But I know that when I look back at some of the topics we've covered that were very close to me, I regret that we did them so early on, because I'd like to go back and give them the attention that we could give them now that we've developed a better way of storytelling. So that is the tricky part. And I think what you have to do is, when you're doing the investigation, you have to keep an eye out for components of your research that would make a good storytelling component. And then you have to learn how to separate that from the more mundane information, which is another thing that it's taken us 5 years to get good at too. And we've gotten lots of feedback. Oh, you have too many tangents, or you went on and on about X, Y, or Z, and that wasn't germane to the story. But conversely, our brand now is including all that information and doing these really deep dives. And we decided just to own that and lean into it, because trying to cover it up or get away from it is it just doesn't make sense for us. But we have tried to be less tangential in terms of our discussions that take us too far off topic. But it's a roundabout way to answer that question, I guess, which demonstrates that I'm still not quite good at it. So.
What are some of the wrong ways that you've identified? Because you I don't want to say this is a luxury, because there's a lot of work that goes into putting together a 2 to 3 hour show like you guys have sometimes. But we, you have, we don't have time to air anything out. We have to do it. We have 15 minutes. Uh-huh. And, so we want to get right to the point, you know, what doing things, everything the right way, like, right?
Yes. Yes. Well, and that's, you know, that's all about calling it down. And that's just about editing, really, editorial, editing your concepts, editing the material you want to cover, getting it shorter. And it's interesting you should say that, because we're looking at trying to develop a new show that's sort of a shorter, easier thing to digest. And so we're going to have to learn how to do that ourselves. And I'd like to think it's not going to be that hard at this point, but it's taken us a long time. I mean, part of the problem is the nature of your personality or the people that are doing it. And sure. We do a lot of the research ourselves, and Forrest and I both have obsessive tendencies, and we have we'll both be like, you know what, I would be so embarrassed if we ran this whole thing and we didn't mention that they recovered that weird missing object, and it's actually on display in a small museum somewhere or something like that. So we're always working really hard to make sure that we're not leaving anything out. But now we've gotten to a point where we're trying to selectively choose to leave things out, which is the point you're going to be at if you're trying to do something in 15 minutes. So this is where that gets really hard, because what happens is you have to learn and research everything to figure out what you don't want to use. And it's so you, that's, the, and that's for us is the hardest part of the job, is because we have to get fully up to speed, and we have, Forrest used to work in a field where these people, you know, use all these stupid business terms. And one of them was like, we have to 501 this, because, you know, referring to a college level course, we have to get 501 on it. So it's like, you go as far as you can, you get all this information, and then we got to bring it back down to 101. And that's really part of the challenge is getting all that information in and then deciding what to include to make the story work in a shorter amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any suggestions, like, off the top of your head? I don't know how much they told you about the challenge, but just like any topics that stand out to you that could be done in 15 minutes, because I just feel kind of like everything is so much research and so much what you were just talking about. So just curious.
Well, I mean, with regard to the contest, I don't know exactly. Are your topics all a similar vein to what we do, or is it something else?
No, it's
we have free reign.
Investigation.
Okay. Just investigate.
Yeah, just an investigative podcast.
Right.
In 15 minutes.
Well, I would say then, you know, it's tricky, because a lot of times what you can do, I mean, it's like if you compare us, our show, to Aaron Mankey's Lore. Lore is a, the original Lore anyway, is a shorter version of what we do. Mm-hmm. And he, of course, follows the narrative style. He's a writer, so he has this whole different approach. And that's what we would say to people when people complain to us. They would come to us and say, you're too long. It's too much. What? Just tell me what the thing is and where it is or what happened. And we just say, go listen to Lore. You know, they've got this. Mm-hmm. You're going to hear that version of it there. And it's going to be a great version of it, but it's different from us. So I think in terms of finding a topic that you can cover that quickly that you want to do an investigation on, your best bet, and this is a weird thing to say, but the best bet is to look at things that there's not a whole lot of information about. Because if either all the witnesses are dead, it happened so long ago, there's not a whole lot to recover. And then you have to put together what you think happened. It involves more speculation. And that's something that you can easily do in a short amount of time. So you get that information together and you make an educated guess about it. And you know, accept the fact that you're not doing a deep dive. You're not looking for eyewitnesses. You're not trying to track down, you know, you're just trying to get, you're looking at the overview of the story and you're going to do a small version of it. So, mm-hmm. You know. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, because you kind of brought up investigation, whatever. What would you say that's what investigating is kind of like making your own thought of what you think happened, like versus reporting? Like, where is that fine line?
Well, no, I definitely would not say that. We, you know, one of the things that we like to do is we like to present all the evidence we can possibly find, from the mundane to the fringe, in our case, and fringe is more appropriate for our show, but and then let the listeners make a choice. But what we will do towards the end sometimes, and we don't always do this, is if we have a position, we'll say what we think, but we're not trying to be a cult leader. We're not trying to tell you that you have to believe what we thought. We're just trying to give you the benefit of our investigative experience over the past 5 years looking at these particular types of stories. We've started to recognize patterns and see things. So we'll say that. We'll call it out, because the real thing that you have to look out for, and we talk about this a lot on our show, especially when you're an investigator, is confirmation bias. Mm-hmm. And that is you can very nobly say, well, I'm not going to have any. I'm going to be completely impartial. But it's just not going to happen, because when you look into something, whether it's a murder or a mystery or whatever, you're going to come across people that were involved that you believe or don't believe. Maybe they're super charismatic, like Robert Downey Jr., and you think there's no way that guy could have done this. Or but then you go back and you look at Ted Bundy, and you know what? He was real charming too. So it's kind of like you've got to try to put all that aside. But I think for us, we try to stay responsible by pointing out our own confirmation bias whenever we can, and saying, "Look, you know, I know I'm coming at this from this angle. This particular person, I actually believe, but I only can say that on a gut reaction, and my gut reaction is based on my own life experience, and it may or may not be the right reaction."
Right. When you're editorializing, let people know you're editorializing. Right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what is it? So, because we have a short amount of time to do all the research, do you know any like what is your go-to way to do research? Like you need quick information now.
Honestly, we start the shallowest, you know, jumping off point is Wikipedia, frankly. That's the first place, sure, you go to look. And, you know, some Wikipedia pages are completely useless. Other ones are absolutely amazing. And so you start there, and then, you know, you read the entry, but the ones that are well done, at the bottom of the entry, there's 1,000 links, mm-hmm, that will take you to all kinds of great stuff, usually, that you can click on. Now, we have the benefit of these volunteer researchers in our group that, and some of them are specialists. They have access to the Library of Congress, or their legal aid, so they can get into LexisNexis. So we do get access to things that that other people can't necessarily get to. So that's really nice. We have somebody who can just find any magazine article or newspaper article. And a lot of that stuff, you have to be part of a paid service. And so these people will be part of that. And we pay for some as well. But in other cases, it's just about access if you're in the academic world or that sort of thing. So you have to look out for that. But, you know, and we do look at academic papers as well. But everything you find, you have to take with a grain of salt, because everything has a viewpoint in it, no matter how impartial it pretends to be. And that's something we've discovered, too, on a couple of topics that we've covered, where maybe we come across an academic paper and it turns out to be riddled with mistakes. Mm-hmm. So it's very good to verify as much material as you can. Boy, I tell you what, this 15-minute time limit's got me hot under cover. I'm used to being able to go for like 3 hours.
Something for you to train for, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I need more of this, I think.
Where do you draw the line to drop a subject? Do you just bull through and make it work? Or is there like a place in your research that you go, you know what, this isn't going to work, let's cut our losses?
We try to make that decision before we get too far with it. And it's sort of we have a vetting process that we go through. Not really a process. It's just kind of like, let's look into this. Let's see if it'll stand up to the rigors of putting a show together. We have not ever really had to walk away from anything. There was one show we had to walk away from, only because it related to a murder with where the victims had surviving family members, and we felt like it was a story that the family members would not necessarily want to hear. So we kiboshed that episode. We may come back to it when everyone has moved on to the next life, maybe. But it's that one was a hard one. And then I think the hardest one that we tried to make a story out of that wasn't really there, related to this video game called Polybius, which supposedly put people in trances and government mind control, mm-hmm, and all that. And when we started digging into that, and we found out that the bulk of it was really hearsay. And you know what? We decided to just go with it and have fun with the fictionalized aspects of it. And then at the end, we basically said, you know, I don't think this happened. And we're not afraid to do that. So that would be what we would do in that case. But we're better at vetting now than we were when that happened.
Do you always go for do you always get people to talk to, interviews, or do you have cases where you don't?
In some cases, we don't. It depends on if there's a good source. We usually look for a good author who's written a respected book or has a really interesting story, and we will try to reach out to those people when we can, but we're not afraid to do a show without talking to somebody.
Let's see how things went when they met with the coach, Tom Merritt.
Hey!
Hammond said talk, so we all talked at the same
time. Yeah. We follow what Hammond says, without question, at all times. Just like every week from now on, if you want to talk about why the judges thought what they thought, then we can talk about that. But otherwise, we can just focus on the next week's challenge.
Let's
move on. Yeah, Bobby. Okay. So this, what we chose to do and the direction we're going in is cults. And we haven't really talked about how we're framing the whole overall podcast, but this episode specifically is about the Fall River satanic cult quote unquote cult. So we're just in research phase right now with that. We do have a couple of questions. So the format that we are thinking about going in is... we're doing the story in a very formal and serious way, and then each of us is going to read like different parts of it. That's just like an idea that we've thrown out, but we're wondering like how can we push this more, or if we even have to, or if that will be fine, like just to do us telling this about this cult.
Why are you having three different voices? If I'm listening to this, why will it make sense that the voices change?
We're trying to figure out a way to make that make sense. Like some people are... So there's a, let me back up for a second. There's sort of a logistical or listening reason why I thought that it might be nice to have three voices. And that's because the nature of the story that we're doing, we're not going to have any like interview audio or even any audio we can pull from different places. So I thought that it might help to
break it up
with fatigue of just listening to one person go on, about the same story for 15 minutes. But so I'm trying to, and this is a good question for you, I guess, is I'm trying to think of a way that we can make it make sense, the different people, like maybe different parts of the case, you know, like one of us is usually talking when we're talking about like one of the characters or one of the victims or something like that. Another person's talking when we're talking about like when the police are investigating and what they found and stuff like that. And it goes back and forth, but like, it's almost as if like that's our area that we talk about, you know?
Yeah. I get what you're saying. It's not really the right way to go to say, we need three voices. How do we make that work? it's better to say what makes for the good investigative podcast. And that's where you've got the dilemma, which is, well, a good investigative podcast is interesting to listen to. And one voice all the way through, unless you're Dan Carlin, may not be that interesting to listen to. So yeah, you have to, you know, fairly evaluate that stuff. And that's to your credit that you're thinking about that. There are other ways to break it up. You can do different voices reading newspaper headlines or quotes from people. And it sounded like that's kind of what you were talking about, like having the voice of a victim or police be different people. You could have a narrator and then go to different voices when you talk about that. It could be a little cheesy to do reenactments, but it doesn't have to be. So you could do something like that. But again, that starts to get into acting, and that's a little iffy. Go ahead, okay. Melissa.
Yeah, that was my question because I had brought that up earlier, but Bobby and Kristen said during Science Week you guys had suggested staying away from that. But I guess to clarify, if we do go that route, can we do it in a way like to keep it authentic and not so acty? Could we do it in a way where like Bobby's the main narrator and then I'm like, okay, and now I'm going to so-and-so statement or her interview.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Like when you have quotes, when you have newspaper clippings, even if it's just like, you know, a report in the Oregon Twin Falls Press remarked on this. And then Melissa's voice comes in and is reading that clip, right? Mm-hmm. That isn't a reenactment. That isn't acty or false. You could even do like a 911 call reenactment, as long as you're not like trying to be all dramatic and it doesn't fall well, because you've seen that on like 48 Hours and stuff, that can come off really cheesy. But short of like trying to act, if you're just like changing the voice because the source of the information is changing, I think that's perfectly legitimate.
Okay. What is your overall thought on what we're doing? Like, I just want to get a vibe of, like, is it too boring or too standard, or is it going to be fine?
Let me ask you about the Fall River Satanic Cult, because I'm not familiar with it. What's interesting about it?
So, we're going... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, so the interesting thing about this case is that it's not clear. It was a series of unsolved murders and disappearances in 1979, right around the Satanic Panic going on in the country, you know. And there also at the same time was a prostitution ring that apparently dabbled in satanic worship. But by the end of the investigation, it wasn't clear, even though the person had claimed that it was part of the satanic cult, there was a lot of controversy in that it wasn't clear whether or not they were just using the
satanic panic frantic.
I'm gonna short circuit this. What is the question you are investigating?
Whether or not it was.
Whether or not what was.
Is it
part of a cult, or is it just people murdering people?
Was Fall River just a cult, or just
Fall River is the area, is the town.
I want you to make a sentence that you can put at the front of your show that says, on this episode, we are going to find out, was this thing a cult, or just murders, or both?
right.
Yes.
I'm serious. I want you to tell me this sentence right now.
Okay. Here's the focus sentence that I came up with. In the fall of 1979, police questioned Karen Marsden about
too many words already. I want a very simple sentence.
So
Karen Marsden came to the police because she was afraid of a cult that she was in. And then she was scared by going to the police that she was going to get murdered next.
And that's not a question that you're answering. Mm-hmm.
So basically the very basic sum of it is, were the Fall River murders of 1979 a result of
a satanic cult worship,
or were they using that as cover? Or like you said, both, because it could be both.
There you go. You almost nailed it right there. The Fall River murders of 1979 just murders, a satanic cult, or both?
Okay.
Maybe not both. Both doesn't really make sense. But you get where I'm going. Yeah. Like, okay, there's your focus. That's what you're investigating. And now you've answered the question of, is this a good topic? Yes. Satanic cult murders, or just, you know, or a cover up. Actually, there's your sentence. Were the 1979 Fall River murders a satanic cult, or a cover up for something more real, but just as evil?
Okay.
Chilling.
Yeah, right? See, there you go. Yeah. You've got a great topic.
I have to write this down.
I feel better. I'm recording it.
Thank God. Well, no.
And that's why you need that. You need that sentence, because now you have something to tell people at the beginning that's going to hook them and go, okay, I want to find out. And now you can write this in a way that even if when you're in the single narrator part, it's going to be feeding that question. Everything you write in here needs to point towards answering that question.
Okay, we have like 1 minute, but there's two murders before we get to Karen Marsden. So like, when do we talk about that? I feel like we have to. Mm-hmm. But then,
yeah,
of course. Okay. I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. And you'll figure out where those fall. But you can start with Karen Marsden coming to the police. That's a great way to entry in, but that wasn't the reason she was scared were these two previous murders. And then that's your way into talking about those. And what you're talking about isn't just that there were murders, but what were the hallmarks of those murders that made people think it was a satanic cult? And what are the hallmarks that make you think maybe it wasn't?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. I already have answers to these questions.
Good.
Good.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, I think a problem we were having, Tom, and you really, really helped with was I had a focus sentence, but like you said, it was too long. I think you helped us distill it down.
It sounded like what you had is a good intro to the show, where like in 1979, this, you know, that kind of thing. But you need to have that really tight, punchy focus sentence. You can also use that as a title. You can use that as a tease. It helps in a lot of different ways.
Let's listen in on their work sessions.
We're thinking at different levels, which is fine. Mm-hmm. But I think I'm definitely on a level of like, we do research and Google stuff and find a story and then talk or recite that. I don't know. That's not a good word, but like tell it. Like they're, I don't know. That's how I'm viewing it. So like with true crime, like the story is already written. It's about that person, you know, like, and we're telling that person's death story, you know?
It's really, what is the story? And it's investigation is so open-ended.
Did you guys have any initial thought or idea thoughts?
I was
like
trying
when
to
they
go ahead.
Gave the challenge or whatever.
I didn't have any that jumped out at me. So investigation, let's try to think outside the box a little bit. Like investigation often feels like just the word makes you think that you need to go in and like solve a mystery, right? But does it really mean that, you know?
I keep going back to true crime, but I know I'd like my gut is telling me not to go with that.
Really? My gut is screaming at me to do that. Or go that direction, I guess.
I think if we do go a true crime angle, it has to be something unique. It can't just be like, you're right, with true crime is obviously true crime. They're the, you know, the who, the what, the where, the when, the how is all, I mean, in theory, most of that is already talked about. That's the whole point.
So to get juices flowing, let me throw out ideas that I don't think we should go with, but are just in a different direction. you could investigate some sort of pseudoscience phenomenons, for example, crop circles, or there's a whole thing about like religious statues crying. And there are people that literally like have gone into and investigated and discovered the reasons why this happens. And so there's that kind of a thing you could do. Karen Marsden likely never imagined she'd be where she was on this day in 1979. A sex worker sitting in a police interview room next to her lover, a fellow sex worker, across from detectives, admitting her involvement with a Satan-worshipping cult which was implicated in the disappearance and murder of two young women in Fall River, Massachusetts. It's a lot to take in, and it was a lot for her to take in as well, especially as she was about to name her pimp as the killer of one of the victims, an act she was convinced would make her the next sacrifice in the cult's gruesome killing spree. You're listening to Cult Case with myself, Bobby Frankenberger, Melissa Krueger, and Kristen Stubblefield. This is a show that opens the books on claims of cult activity to take a closer look and see what's really happening. On this week's episode, we dive into the Fall River cult murders of 1979 and 1980. The question we want to answer is, were the Fall River murders the result of satanic sacrifices, or was the cult merely a smokescreen to confuse police and provide reason to pin the blame on someone else? Let's find out. A quick warning that this episode contains graphic descriptions of violence and sexual acts. Listener discretion is advised. On October 13th, 1979, the body of a young girl was found behind the Diamond Vocational High School in Fall River, Massachusetts. The body was identified as Doreen Levesque, a 17-year-old sex worker who ended up in Fall River after running away from her home. Forensics determined the murder was possibly a death by stoning as some sort of ritual and likely committed by multiple people.
About a month after Doreen's body was found, with no leads up to this point, Andy Maltese walked into the police station to report his girlfriend, Barbara Raposa, missing. After speaking with Andy, the police began to notice resemblances between Barbara and Doreen's lifestyles. Both were young sex workers working in the Bedford Street area. He also made a comment about a satanic cult and mentioned he had had information on Doreen's death. This mention of a satanic cult coincided with the forensic analysis of a possible ritual involvement. Pushing this lead further, Andy revealed that the three of them were involved in the same cult, in which he believed was responsible for both the death of Doreen and the disappearance of his girlfriend. Unfortunately, he didn't have any additional information beyond this, but he did know two other cult members that might: Karen Marsden and Robin Murphy.
Karen and Robin were two young sex workers who worked in the Bedford Street area, along with victims Doreen and Barbara. The two of them had been childhood friends and were open about being romantically involved. Karen was a 20-year-old single mother, a drug addict, and was trying desperately to make ends meet in a former textile city that was now economically failing. Life wasn't treating her well, but she was willing to talk to the police despite the risk. Now, why was this a risk? Because Karen was about to name Carl Drew as Doreen Levesque's murderer, a man who was not just her manager, commonly referred to as a pimp, but also someone she feared would have her killed for talking to the police.
Unfortunately, aside from Karen Marsden's statement and accusation of Carl Drew as the murderer, there wasn't a lot of physical evidence to tie him to the crime, definitely not enough to have him arrested. They also only had the statement of one person, Karen. Robin Murphy, Karen's friend who came with her to talk to the police, said nothing during the interview. It was noted that she seemed unusually calm and disconnected, a stark contrast to her partner Karen, who was panicked, emotional, and oftentimes incoherent.
And it's for that reason the case would remain open for some time. The police continued to talk to Karen over the next couple of months, along with interviewing others connected to the sex ring. However, there wasn't quite enough evidence to arrest Carl Drew for the murder of Doreen Levesque. For 3 months, things remained stagnant. Then on January 26, Barbara Raposa's body was finally found. Her body was discovered frozen and bloodied in some woods behind an abandoned printing factory. She was found in a remarkably similar state to that of Doreen Levesque's body, wrist bound by fishing line, sexually assaulted, and skull crushed with a rock. The police immediately interviewed Andy Maltese as the number one suspect in the crime. He was her boyfriend and the last person to see her alive. At the time of the interview, he denied any knowledge of the crime, but returned to the police after a few days with a very accurate detail of the crime, which he claimed came to him in a psychic dream. Shortly after, Andy Maltese was arrested and charged with the murder of his girlfriend, Barbara Raposa.
During the 2 months after their interview with the police, Robin Murphy had remained silent. She hadn't made any statements to the police about either the missing Barbara or Doreen's murder. However, after Andy was arrested for Barbara's murder, Robin finally decided to talk. Robin stated that she was with Andy on the night of the murder. She would later testify in court that Andy had told her of his intention to murder Barbara as retribution for dating someone else. That same night, the two of them, Robin and Andy, picked up Barbara from a local diner. Andy drove them out near an abandoned printing factory, led Barbara into the woods, had sex with her, and murdered her by smashing her head with a large rock. After getting back into the car where Robin was waiting, he threatened to have someone get her if she ever came forward about what had happened. Robin's eyewitness testimony would be incredibly useful in the case against Andy Maltese, but she still had more to offer. Now that she was talking to the police, she stated that she had information on the Doreen Levesque murder, the case that started this whole investigation 3 months ago. Robin claimed that she had been present at both murders. And while the forensic evidence was nearly identical in both cases, these two murders were unrelated. In fact, Robin would go on to confirm the story of her friend Karen and name Carl Drew as Doreen's murderer. Furthermore, she would claim that Doreen's murder was an offering of the soul to Satan, a price to be paid for attempting to leave Carl Drew's coven of Satan worshippers.
Now, at this point, it might seem unexpected that Robin Murphy would come forward so suddenly and so dramatically with details about the rituals of a demonic cult and murders as offerings to Satan. However, the police weren't surprised at all. You see, all the time that Robin had spent quiet in the 2 months before the second body, that of Barbara, was found in the woods, Karen Marsden, Robin's friend, had been continuing to talk to the police. She had a lot to say. Karen had already named Carl Drew as Doreen's murderer back when she first spoke with the police in November, and she would continue to paint a darker picture of Carl. She described Carl as the devil, who led a literal satanic cult. He organized his group of sex workers into a satanic coven in order to maintain control over them with an iron fist. He'd threaten the girls, frequently saying things like, "Satan will take his toll if they didn't obey him." Now, Karen also took the police to key locations with ties to the cult. She'd show them wooded locations where nocturnal gatherings were often held. In these locations, the police would find evidence of satanic rituals, animal carcasses, sheep bones, even dolls with their eyes poked out. She showed them the places where Carl Drew would warn them that he'd dumped the body of girls who disobeyed him. She described how he would threaten to inject their veins with battery acid before offering their souls to Satan. Karen even claimed to be present for both the murders of Doreen Levesque and Barbara Raposa. She stated that while Carl Drew was the cult leader who orchestrated the killings, Robin Murphy also played a leading role in the murders and was directly involved. Karen claimed that Robin was absolutely present at both murders along with some of other girls from the cult. According to Karen, Robin made all the girls present and participate in the mutilation of the bodies. Robin told the girls that their participation was necessary for ritualistic purposes, but Karen told the police that she believed it was to keep them silent, since they would have been directly involved by mutilating the bodies. Now, with this information out, Karen expressed a great deal of paranoia about being targeted herself. She'd given so much information about the cult, satanic worship, the rituals, Carl Drew's cult leadership. She'd even incriminated her partner, Robin Murphy.
And this is why the police weren't surprised at all when Robin Murphy came forward with information about satanic cults and rituals. However, Robin's version of the story didn't exactly match with Karen's version, as you might imagine.
A point that was punctuated when Karen was suddenly reported missing on February 9th, 1980.
Karen's body would be found 2 months later. And thanks to the independent testimony of two other girls in the cult who claimed to be witnesses, Robin Murphy was named as Karen's killer. This was enough information to warrant an arrest, and so Robin Murphy was taken into custody. Carl Drew, the ringleader of the satanic coven of sex workers he had forced together under his rule, was also arrested.
After she was in custody, Robin Murphy admitted to being involved in the murder of Karen Marsden. However, she claimed that Carl Drew forced her and others to participate. According to her, Carl had decided that Karen was too much of a risk. She had seen too much, been present at the murders, and was talking to the police. She was a liability and needed to be taken care of. Robin claimed that he knew the other girls were also talking to the police, but that they could atone and prove their loyalty to the cult by participating in the murder of Karen Marsden. In her initial statement, Robin claimed that Carl made her drag Karen from the car into the woods. She was then told to pull out Karen's hair, after which her and the other girls present participated in a ritual stoning of Karen. Carl Drew then cut off one of Karen's fingers, broke her neck with his bare hands, and then made Robin slit Karen's throat. The murder only got more gruesome and disturbing after that. Robin claimed that Carl paid homage to Satan by carving an X into Karen's torso, and while speaking in tongues, marked an X on Robin's forehead with Karen's blood. Then, in a final act of defilement, he made Robin perform sexual acts on Karen's headless body.
Carl Drew was sentenced to life in prison with no possibility of parole. Robin Murphy was also sentenced to life in prison, but with the possibility of parole. Robin's case was not as cut and dry. First of all, Robin changed her story more than once during her interviews with the police, her lawyers, and also in court. As the prosecution would point out during the trial, the details of her story didn't match up with the details given by other eyewitnesses. This gave Robin a serious credibility problem in the eyes of the court and the jury. However, it also served to confuse the issue and make it difficult to charge her in the murders of Doreen Levesque and Barbara Raposa. These difficulties surrounding the case led to a great deal of controversy in the media. One of the main questions surrounding this case was whether or not a cult was even involved at all. However, the real question to us, and the central question this investigation was aiming to answer, is whether or not these murders were satanic rituals. Or were they supposed rituals being used as a cover by Robin to protect herself from full culpability?
It's pretty clear that a satanic cult did exist. This fact was stated by many people in the community, and most importantly, several women who claimed to be members of the cult who weren't connected to the murders. Perhaps more importantly, as part of their investigation, two of the detectives on the case were able to witness firsthand a cult gathering where a ritual ceremony was performed. It's also clear that the satanic rituals were being performed in Fall River at the time of these murders. Not only did the detectives witness some of these rituals, but several independent eyewitnesses who were members of the cult testified to participating in animal sacrifices and blood rituals. It's highly unlikely that all of these people independently imagined the same rituals and events. So, was Robin Murphy a willing participant in these ritual killings, or was she forced to participate by a domineering and manipulating Carl Drew?
Now, over time, Robin's story has changed. She first claimed to not be present at the murders. Then she claimed to have witnessed and participated in a murder. Then, later in 1984, she claimed to a parole board that she made the entire thing up in order to get Carl Drew put in prison, because she believed him responsible for Karen Marsden's death along with several other women, and she thought that the only way to get him proper justice was just to fabricate this whole story. Now, lest we get too comfortable with the idea that Robin's the only untrustworthy side of this story, there were many, many reports of police misconduct and witness tampering and manipulation as well. It was also reported that the state was paying for many of Robin's expenses while she was in custody, and substantial rewards were offered to her in exchange for her testimony. Please don't forget that Robin Murphy was a 17-year-old sex worker under the control of a man, Carl Drew, who, by all accounts, was violent and controlling, a very dangerous person. The best that can be done is to realize that the question of whether Carl Drew forced Robin to commit these acts as part of a cult ritual, or Robin used the cult as a cover for murder, is a false dichotomy at best. What's more likely is that the truth lies somewhere between these two extremes. If Robin Murphy, a young 17-year-old girl, found herself in an abusive relationship with a sex trafficker like Carl Drew, then she might start to do things out of self-preservation. She might convince herself that she belongs there. She might see this community of other cult followers, as strange as we might find it, a source of comfort, a group of people who were sharing in her struggles. And then, out of a sense of survival, she might find herself violently defending the only support structure available to her, or doing things that she might never have done to avoid becoming a murder victim herself. She might even take up a leadership role in this coven in order to protect herself. Now, does this mean that what she did was right? Certainly not. That's not what we're trying to say. But we can at least see the complicated nature of something so difficult to understand. The resources from today's show are from the website cultnation.com and Justia U.S. Law and the specific cases of Commonwealth versus Andre O. Maltese and Commonwealth versus Carl H. Drew. Thank you for listening, and join us next week for Cult Case.
That was Cult Case, the investigative podcast submission from the Stick Figure Squad. On the next episode, we'll blow this case wide open with our judging and elimination episode, where one team wins, one player goes home, and I turn over my gun and badge to the chief because this time I've crossed the line. It's all coming up this week on America's Next Top Podcaster.